Despite increased fighting along the route to Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, the IAEA mission presses on.
We consider that we have the minimum conditions to move, accepting that the risks are very, very high.
Plus, the change in approach to Africa from Mikhail Gorbachev's Soviet Union to Vladimir Putin's Russia. And later in the program...
The first day of school in Ukraine will not include children sharing memories of fun vacations with their families. Their stories are more likely to be on surviving war.
Many children haven't been in a classroom since the start of the war. What of those close to the fighting? Today is Thursday, September 1st. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. A team of UN experts arrived at Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power complex on Thursday to assess the risk of a radiation disaster after being delayed several hours by shelling near the site. Rafael Grossi, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who's also leading the mission, said earlier that their mission would not be deterred by the increased military activity.
Weighing the pros and cons, and having come so far, we are not stopping. We consider that we have the minimum conditions to move, accepting that the risks are very, very high. Still, myself and the team, we believe that we can proceed with this. We have a very important mission to accomplish.
Joining us with more is reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, the mission from the International Atomic Energy Agency arrived at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. That was confirmed by Reuters reporters on the scenes, and they have also said that it looks like some have also left the facility. But what do we know in terms of what's happening there?
Yes, it was confirmed also by the Enerhoatom representative that officials that actually the mission finally made it to the site. What we know for the moment, and this is the most detail that we have, so the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, said that representatives of the organization will remain at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant.
We are finishing our long-awaited visit to the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. I have just completed a first tour of the key areas that we wanted to see in this first approach to the whole facility. Of course, there is a lot more to do. My team is staying on. And more importantly, and most importantly, we are establishing a continued presence from the IAEA here.
Again, Ukrainian representatives were not present.
And we've also learned that the team at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is expected to stay until around September 3rd. What else can you tell us about the delay in the mission actually arriving at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant because of that continued fighting?
Their trip to the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant was very difficult and very dangerous. From the very morning, we were getting reports from the Ukrainian intelligence that actually the city of Enerhoatom itself was under heavy shelling, and the Zaporizhia region in general as well. And the shelling of the city of Enerhodar was since 5 o'clock in the morning today, local time. And we hear it from the intelligence and from the officials, from the mayor of the city of Enerhodar and from the head of the Zaporizhia military administration, Mr. Staruch. Also, we know that due to this shelling, the mission was stopped at one of the checkpoints on the Ukrainian-controlled territory. They had to wait until it was more or less safe, or at least safer, to continue their trip. We know that this happened something like 20 kilometers from the front line, so they were still at the Ukrainian controlled territory. The most important is, I guess, coming because, of course, everyone is waiting for Rafael Grossi to actually come to either Kyiv or Zaporizhia, and everyone is waiting for his further comments and maybe giving us more details, because for the moment we don't have neither information about the state of the plant, the state of the reactors, nor about the future plans. So this is probably something the most expected for the moment.
From Kyiv, Ukraine, Anna Chernikova. Anna, thank you very much for your reporting.
Thank you, Steve.
Visit voanews.com/flashpoint for more updates throughout the day. The European Union announced on Wednesday that it would be suspending its visa facilitation agreement with the Russian Federation because of the conflict in Ukraine. Josep Borrell, the EU foreign policy chief, briefed reporters on the decision. And just a heads up, the audio has a bit of an echo.
First, full suspension of the European Union Russia visa facilitation agreement. Full suspension. Until now, it was partially suspended for special collectives, groups of people, officials and entrepreneurs, and now it's fully suspended. This will it will significantly reduce the number of new visas issued by the EU member states. It's going to be more difficult, it's going to be longer, the process, and consequently, the number of new visas will be substantially reduced.
He added that the EU is prepared to face the negative consequences of Russian aggressions against Ukraine. Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty's Stuart Greer recently sat down with Romanian Foreign Minister Bogdan Urescu. In addition to the question of Russian visas to the EU, they discussed a number of other topics prior to Wednesday's meeting, and that's where we pick things up now as Moscow once more reduces the gas supply to Europe.
What capacity does Romania have to boost production in electricity and possibly boost exports to help its partners next door?
Well, I'm afraid Romania is not yet an export country. We are working on that because we are working on starting the exploitation of our hydrocarbon resources in the Black Sea continental shelf, the level of 2025-2026 year. And since then, well, perhaps we will also help, we will be able, and we want to be able to also help other partners in coping with the energy crisis. It is true, on the other hand, that Romania is one of the less dependent countries in terms of energy imports from other sources, including from Russia. And we work together with our partners in order to improve the capacity of the European Union to be less dependent on Russia. We will not discuss this matter explicitly during this meeting of the foreign ministers because this is a matter for the meeting of the energy ministers, which will be convened on the 9th of September, if I remember correctly. And but this is an important, very important matter, because what is really relevant if we discuss about the relations between EU and Russia, if we speak about the EU-Russia relations, I think the most important issue is to be and to act in order to become less dependent, to become independent of any kind of influence from Russia. Our resilience is, in fact, at stake.
And do you see Romania doing more to attract foreign investments, to exploit these offshore gas reserves in the Black Sea, for example, maybe having some sort of tax incentives or cutting red tape to attract foreign investment to exploit these resources?
Well, I think you should interview my colleague, the Minister of Energy, who will no doubt come to Prague and will give you more details about our plans. But we do have a plan on this issue, and we are trying to move in such a manner as to increase our energy independence. We also want to develop our production of nuclear power, and we have a plan on this as well to develop two new reactors at our nuclear power plant in Romania. We have also embarked upon on a very ambitious plan to become a hub for the development and production of small modular reactors, parts at the level of 2028, 2029. And we hope that in Romania, at that time frame, we will have the first power plant using this new American technology of small modular reactors.
On grain and corn exports from Ukraine, a lot of it's going through Romania, of course. What can Romania do to increase the volume that's being shipped through the Black Sea port of Constanta and barges via the Danube as well?
I think we have done a lot to increase our capacities. We still have to do more. One has to say that last year there was basically no shipments of Ukrainian grain through Romania because Ukraine was using its own ports and the Black Sea routes to the Black Sea Straits and from that to third country destinations. But since the beginning of the war, we have improved our capacity to facilitate the transit of these shipments. And as of 17th of August, for instance, more than 3.4 billion tons of million tons of Ukrainian grain have been shipped through Romania, which is more than a half of the total of the Ukrainian grain exports during this period. And we continue with this. We have acted in order to facilitate the transit. It's not just about the Constanța port, but also about the Galați port on the Danube. We have modernized a wide gauge railway connection from the border with Ukraine to the Galați port itself in order to be able to bring Ukrainian grain directly. You know that there is this issue of difference of gauge between the Soviet
the gauge of the track,
the gauge of the rail, and we have improved our transit capacities, but of course we need to do more. We count on the functioning of this deal, which was reached at the end of July, with the help of the United Nations and Turkey. But again, we have to use, I think, all routes available, and Romania is the closest country and provides for the closest routes for the export of Ukrainian grain. It's very important to facilitate this transit in order to cope with the possible food crisis in countries like Africa or Middle East.
That's Romanian Foreign Minister Bogdan Orezco speaking with RFERL's Stuart Greer. Now, last month, Daria Dugina was killed in a car bomb attack outside of Moscow. Polygraph.info fact-checks statements by the Russian embassy.
On August 23rd, the Russian embassy in Washington condemned the U.S. for, quote, making Russophobic remarks about the car bombing that killed Daria Dugina near Moscow. The 29-year-old Dugina was the daughter of ultra-nationalist Alexander Dugin, an ideological ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin. At a U.S. State Department briefing, spokesman Ned Price said, "We condemned the targeting of civilians, whether that's in Kyiv, whether that's in Bucha, Kharkiv, Kramatorsk, Mariupol, or whether that's in Moscow." The Russian embassy objected, saying Price, quote, "took the liberty to draw a similarity between what had happened and some false flag operations that the Russian Federation had allegedly carried out, but that is false." Price never said anything about false flag attacks. Rather, Price named places where there is evidence of Russian war crimes, attacks on civilians. A bombing killed hundreds inside a civilian shelter in Mariupol. Soldiers executed at least 50 civilians in Bucha. In Kramatorsk, a missile attack on a crowded train station killed 60 civilians. The Kremlin accused Ukraine of faking atrocities in Bucha. Witness accounts and the bodies left behind debunk that claim. Daria Dugina was a TV host who called for eliminating Ukrainian identity. Russia's spy agency accused Ukraine of assassinating her. Ukraine denied any involvement. At Dugina's funeral, prominent Russian politicians called for vengeance.
Polygraph.info is a fact-checking website produced by The Voice of America. The website serves as a resource for verifying the increasing volume of disinformation as well as misinformation that's being distributed and shared globally. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. As the world reflects after the passing of former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, VOA's Cain Fairbaugh shares the thoughts of international reporters and his own memories of what it was like to report on the international statesman.
As soon as he arrived in rural Eureka, Illinois, population 5,400, he was the center of attention.
It looks like everyone here in this small town is a photographer.
But former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev wasn't the biggest name to visit these parts. That distinction belonged to the man who was both Gorbachev's adversary and his partner in reshaping geopolitics, former U.S. President Ronald Reagan.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Reagan was an alum of Eureka College, which invited Gorbachev to visit in 2009 to accept an honorary degree, nearly two decades after the collapse of the Soviet Union and roughly 5 years after the former U.S. president's death. I diligently followed Gorbachev through his campus visit, managing to stand on one side of a segment of the Berlin Wall gifted to the college in honor of Reagan, while Gorbachev stood across from me on the other side, reflecting on their historic relationship and the fall of that wall in Europe, both figuratively and literally, as my camera rolled.
Ronald Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And when I'm asked, what was my impression when he said that? I said, it didn't have much of an impact on us. We knew that in his initial career was an actor. But still, I must say that my opinion of Ronald Reagan remains very high.
Mikhail Gorbachev was a patriot of his country. And that was immediately obvious when you encountered him.
Jeffrey Trimble is a former Moscow bureau chief for U.S. News and World Report, who covered Gorbachev during the height of the Cold War. He later served as deputy director of U.S. International Broadcasting.
Mikhail Gorbachev was remarkably accessible to the journalistic community. This was the time of glasnost, of course. So it was relatively easy as a foreign correspondent to get direct access to Gorbachev.
Andrew Nagorsky also worked in Moscow as a correspondent for Newsweek magazine.
He did want to be respected. He did want to present the view of a younger generation.
That view continued into Gorbachev's later years, when he delighted in answering questions from college students 60 years his junior.
President Gorbachev, what do you most want to be remembered for?
I reply to this question always the same way. History is a fickle lady.
I think outside Russia, he will be remembered as a transformational figure.
When asked just how transformational, Gorbachev himself said in 2009 that that opinion might not be unanimous.
There is still a debate going on as to what was done right by Gorbachev and Reagan and what was not done right, but no one can deny one very important fact. The Cold War was ended. We started the process of eliminating nuclear weapons. And relations between our two nations at that time turned into an excellent relationship. There was even euphoria in the Soviet Union for cooperation with the United States.
A euphoria that has since turned to apprehension amid a continuing war in Ukraine that has put Russia and the United States on opposing sides of a conflict.
President Gorbachev, congratulations.
Cain Fairbaugh, VOA News, Eureka, Illinois.
VOA's Carol Van Dam asked Ambassador Johnny Carson, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of African Affairs, to compare and contrast the Soviet Union during Mikhail Gorbachev's leadership with Russia today. He is remembered by many as a man who nurtured peace in several African countries experiencing civil wars. Carson said the Putin administration is trying to exercise much greater influence on Africa than was the case even 10 or 15 years ago.
And in many respects, what Russia is doing today in Africa is negative, or I should say not positive, and in fact destructive. They are a country that has been sending armed forces, armed private armies into various African countries, the Central African Republic and Mali being just a couple, where they have used private paramilitary services to support and bolster governments, some of which have come into power as a result of coup d'etats. This undermines the sovereignty of African countries and does very little to help improve the security of the nations that these Russian mercenaries, armed military units are providing.
Since so much of the world, many of the world leaders are against the Russian invasion in Ukraine, do you see it kind of as a pendulum swing? And do you think things are going to change in Russia and there could be, you know, a different kind of Russian influence in Africa again?
I'm not an expert on Russian politics, and so I can't answer that. The thing that I would say is that I hope Russia would play a more responsible political and economic role in Africa, that it cease to send private military forces into the continent, and that it, in fact, focus on providing development support and investment without strings. But today, it is known mostly for the private militaries that it is sending around the continent.
Is there anything you want to mention, what we're talking about here with Mr. Gorbachev's influence on Africa, that I didn't ask you, that you want to point out?
Let me say that his changes in the Soviet Union rippled down into Africa. And for that, I think many should be thankful. The era that he ushered in terms of allowing the collapse of the Soviet Union, also ushered in a period in which there was greater economic freedom, greater political freedom in Africa, in large measure because the failure of the Soviet Union demonstrated the weakness of the Soviet economic and political models.
That's Ambassador Johnny Carson, a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of African Affairs, and he was speaking with my VOA colleague, Carol Van Dam. And finally, in many areas, the fall academic term has begun in the United States, and likewise, school is starting up again in Ukraine. From the Associated Press, Charles Deledesma brings us this story of Ukrainian students returning to the classroom.
The first day of school in Ukraine will not include children sharing memories of fun vacations with their families. Their stories are more likely to be on surviving war. For many Ukrainian children, their last day of school was the day before the February 24 Russian invasion of their country. At least 379 children have been killed since the war began, while according to Ukraine's General Prosecutor's Office, the whereabouts of over 220 others are unknown. UNICEF spokesman James Elder says education is critical to a return to normality. That's fundamental, but the safety of children remains the priority for now. Schools that don't have quick access to shelters or are located close to the borders with Belarus and Russia or near active military zones will only have online study. I'm Charles Deledesma.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with all the latest developments not only in Ukraine, but on news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com as well as on our social media feeds. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.